Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Sunstone turns 50 this year. For those who don't know, Sunstone is a magazine, or it's a journal about Mormonism, but it's also a community, a kind of gathering place for people who think deeply and critically about the faith. Tonight in Salt Lake City, they'll begin their annual symposium for a mix of scholars and faithful members and ex-members and podcasters and theology nerds. And the lineup, as usual, will be all over the place. There will be presentations on the Book of Abraham, panels on queer spirituality, a look at Mormon internet culture. Scholar Taylor Petrie told us Sunstone emerged from this moment when curiosity and frustration with the limits of official discourse was bursting at the seams. This was around the turn of the 20th century, when science and scholarship like evolution and biblical criticism was starting to challenge literalism and orthodox belief. So he says leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints figured they needed to get out ahead of it.
What if we sent off a bunch of young men to the University of Chicago Divinity School to actually learn something about religion, to learn something about the Bible, Christian history, and bring that knowledge back so that we can ourselves become an intellectual people, be respectable among our religious peers? There are a lot of things that are happening that are challenging traditional religious narratives in these years. Evolution, the Scopes trials, and a kind of biblical literalism versus scientific truth. Latter-day Saints were contending with those issues themselves. Interrelated to that are the new sciences of geology and the history of the earth that are kind of showing that maybe the earth isn't 5,000, 6,000 years old, it's millions and billions of years old. And many intellectual Christians and Latter-day Saints are trying to contend with these new scientific discoveries and to reconcile them with their faith and with the traditional claims of their faith and finding a path forward through that conflict that's emerged. So the church actually sponsors and pays for many of these young men to go off and study and to get these advanced degrees. And then they come back and they become the directors of the institutes at various places in the Intermountain West. Some are studying the Bible, and they are saying things like, maybe the flood didn't really happen, or maybe some of the claims in the Book of Mormon don't always align with what's going on in the Bible. They're also interested in American religious history. And many of these young men discover that maybe Joseph Smith isn't as unique as we thought he was. You know, one of them wrote his master's thesis on the word of wisdom and was surprised that there were other Christians who also believed that tobacco and alcohol were wrong and that he wasn't, you know, bucking a trend. He was actually following a trend in those years. One of them writes to his father and says, I've learned more in one semester about the Bible in this class here than I had learned in my entire life as a member of the Latter-day Saint faith. And this starts to set off some alarm bells among some of the more conservative religious leaders, and they start to push back. Optimism quickly starts to fade, and by the end of that decade, there is a real closing of the ranks and a shunning of many of these scholars who had challenged some of the traditional beliefs of the saints, and that was seen by those conservatives as disrespectful, as potentially wrong, as eroding the faith, and is ultimately dangerous. And the church really kind of said, this was a failure, we're not going to do that anymore. So that intellectual movement that started in the 1930s and was then suppressed afterward, it continued underground in institutes because those people were then teaching institute. They went on to teach people like Leonard Arrington. They went on to be colleagues with Lowell Bunyan and some of the other great middle century intellectuals in the church who taught whole generations of Latter-day Saints to reconcile and to think critically about their faith and to reconcile modern theories of history and modern theories of science with their faith. And by the time we get to the 1970s, many of those then young people who had idealized that sort of intellectual faith decide to go off themselves to divinity school. And they start to study the Bible and Christian history and Christian theology. And they're finding each other. And they say, you know what we should do is we should start a journal of our own and call it Sunstone. And it's a kind of legacy of the Mormon intellectual tradition that they're fostering, but also something that they want to move forward to confront these issues that they see as happening for the very first time as well. But so many Latter-day Saints have never even heard of it. In a way, it used to be that every Latter-day Saint knew what it was. It was something that, you know, church leaders themselves were talking about. And now it's just kind of ignored, it seems. And most Latter-day Saints don't seem to be aware of it and don't seem to be aware of its history and how they're playing out so many of the same conversations and the same concerns and the same kinds of things that are found in the pages of Sunstone over the last 50 years. And it's why I think it remains relevant, because its archive is so rich for Latter-day Saints who are struggling with the same kinds of questions that so many Latter-day Saints are struggling with today. You can read what they said in the 1980s and you're like, this could have been written yesterday. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we have to kind of keep reinventing the wheel. But it's one of the reasons why I think organizations like this are so valuable, both historically and ongoing, as a kind of preservation of that record of Latter-day Saints thinking about these kinds of topics.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. That's Taylor Petrie. He's a professor of religion at Kalamazoo College. And what we wanted to do with the show today is look at where Sunstone fits now in this dynamic, varied universe of thinking and debate about Mormonism, because it's not the only game in town anymore. And so the question is it still relevant in the way it once was? But to understand where Sunstone has ended up, you need to look at how it got here. So let's go back to Taylor Petrie and back to the turn of the 20th century, when religious leaders were trying to make sense of a modern world and figure out how their faith would fit into it.
There's a real realignment of Christianity in the early 20th century, where the 19th century had sort of been a number of denominational differences over what kind of baptism is the right one and what's the right way to celebrate the Sabbath. You know, these were sort of the big controversies of the 19th century. In the 20th century, this realignment happens, where it's a set of orientation to truth claims themselves that really starts to dominate the way that Christians think about their faith. And there's a kind of general schema that scholars talk about, of there being a three-part division of these different categories of how people sort of deal with that issue. On one hand, you've got the secularists who abandon their faith, say, you know, there's nothing here. You know, it's a false tradition. It's wrong on the facts and on morality and so on. There's a very conservative response to that is called fundamentalism, and we can break that down a little bit, named after a set of pamphlets called The Fundamentals that kind of lay out a set of Christian dogmas and doctrines about biblical inerrancy, that you know, the fossil record must be a satanic lie in some way because the Bible is an infallible word of God, right? And then in the middle of these two positions, you get a theological position called the modernists. And they're really trying to reconcile. They're saying, listen, we have to take faith as authoritative and the historical tradition as authoritative, but we can't ignore the facts of the modern world. We can't ignore the fossil record. We can't ignore evolution. We can't ignore some of the errors that Christians in the past had made morally as well. And so the modernists are really trying to kind of forge a new form of faith in these years that can take seriously both the biblical and the theological and Christian tradition and the modern world at the same time.
So what's happening in Mormonism? Are they finding the same kinds of different ideas that are brewing within their faith?
Latter-day Saints are following the exact same trajectory as the rest of Christians. Yeah. They're facing a lot of these same issues. They're having a lot of the same theological crises. They're issuing statements on evolution, and they're worrying about the authority of the Bible itself. There's a new dimension of Mormonism that makes it a little bit different. One is there is a prophetic tradition. So it's not just the authority of the Bible that's at stake. It's the authority of the prophets themselves that are at stake. And in many ways, that sort of biblical infallibility gets transferred to the prophets, that they are infallible in some way as well. So as Mormon fundamentalists are kind of, and I say that with a lowercase f, Mormon fundamentalists are adopting some of they're importing Protestant fundamentalism as a response to modernity. You also have the Mormon modernists who are importing Christian modernism as a response to modernity. Hmm. And there's a third division in Mormonism, it gets a little bit confusing, of the capital F fundamentalists, also in the 1920s and 1930s, who are breaking away from the main church, not on the issue of evolution or on the issue of, you know, the history of the earth or the authority of the Bible, but on the authority of polygamy.
Yeah.
And the authority of the historical prophets, that they could not have been wrong on this issue. And so the fundamentalist position is actually involved in a major conflict between the Mormon fundamentalists with a capital F, who are holding on to plural marriage, and the Mormon fundamentalists with a lowercase f, who are insisting on the authority of the current prophets to overturn the rule of earlier prophets. And there's a sort of internal fight happening among them at the time. And that's the real schism that happens in the church, is actually between the fundamentalists, whereas the modernists and the lowercase Mormon fundamentalists are able to maintain continuity of their fellowship with one another.
So the church eventually manages to jettison the capital F fundamentalists. And that's maybe oversimplifying it, but let's just put it that way for the sake of this conversation. Get us to the two that remain, the small F fundamentalists, more doctrinaire, certainly have a more orthodox, you know, linear view. Mm-hmm. And the other wing, which is somewhat more liberal, we'll just put it that way. And one of the things you've talked about is that the church managed to hold on to those various wings, though certainly those two wings anyway, for quite a while.
Yeah. So one of the fascinating ways that Latter-day Saints hold on to the more conservative and liberal wings of the church is that they call them both into church leadership. And so you've got various liberal figures like B.H. Roberts and James E. Talmage and others who are well-respected, well-regarded intellectuals and are also ecclesiastical leaders at the same time. And you also have more conservative people like Joseph Fielding Smith and J. Reuben Clark, who are deeply entrenched in Protestant fundamentalist literature and are drawing on that tradition as a response to the modernists. And so I mentioned there's a kind of cold war happening between these two factions in the church, but they coexist in part by both holding ecclesiastical leadership and by respecting the ecclesiastical leadership of both of these factions at the same time.
Is it fair to say then that for a while, relative to other Christian faiths, in that sense, being able to hold on to these two wings, Mormonism was relatively progressive. Is that fair?
I think it's more than fair to say it's not only progressive, it's unique. Huh. So many of the other Protestant traditions are dividing over these issues. And Latter-day Saints managed to avoid that, in part because the modernists say, we respect the prophetic tradition. We're adherents to it. The conservatives are relatively tolerant of them over time. They lose their patience at various points. By the end of the 1930s, they've had it with them, you know. But yeah, it is a distinctive element of 20th century Mormonism that both the modernists and the conservative fundamentalists are able to coexist.
But Professor, if you look at the LDS Church leadership today, you wouldn't say there's a smattering of liberals and a smattering of conservatives. When did that break up? That acceptance, that sort of formal acceptance of sort of both ideological perspectives.
Yeah. The middle of the 20th century, the David O. McKay years, are really crucial in establishing this turning point. And in part, it's because there are major internal conflicts between the apostles in these years. And, you know, the conservatives and the more liberal apostles are publicly fighting in a lot of cases. And that's a concerning element for the hierarchy. And they see it as undermining their own authority, as potentially being schismatic, that there's factions forming in the church. And they really want to avoid that. And so they start emphasizing unanimity of thought as a major way that they want to present themselves. And that emphasis on the unanimity of thought isn't just a public way. It also becomes a way that they want to behave privately as well. And so they start calling people who are more aligned with them, especially more conservatively minded folks. And so it isn't fair to say that they're all fundamentalists now, but that's not quite accurate. There are a number of well-educated and progressively minded, relative to some of the members of the church at least, apostles in the church today. But they're much more aligned than they used to be, and they're much more conservative than they used to be on certain issues at least.
That gets us to Sunstone. And talk a little bit about where Sunstone it emerges in the 1970s, a group of students who've gone off to divinity school and want to sort of test some of these ideas within the Mormon context. They start Sunstone. How does that fit in the larger picture of what's going on in the church?
So that optimism that you see in the 1970s really gets turned off in the 1980s. And I think that one of the moments that really signals that is a 1980 talk by an apostle, Ezra Taft Benson at BYU, called The 14 Fundamentals of Following the Prophet, in which he really chastises intellectuals as being insufficiently loyal to the church. He says that they don't need any special training or special knowledge on anything whatsoever, and everything that they say is completely authoritative no matter what. And this really signals, I think, a kind of backlash against this more openness and progressive element of church intellectual life in these years. The 1980s, then, it just gets worse from there. So you have the establishment of the Strengthening of the Church Membership Committee in 1985, which starts to pursue church intellectuals as potentially problematic and tries to, you know, harass and expel them from the church. You have Leonard Arrington, who is the church historian, is pushed out of the church, and a more conservative, faithful history is put forward as the new kind of way that the church is going to do it, as opposed to academic history. That happens in 1982. And by 1989, you have a new apostle, relatively new apostle, Elder Dallin H. Oakes, give a talk saying that alternative voices should be avoided, by which he means coded Sunstone and Dialogue and other liberal spaces. And so the 1980s are really a kind of the beginning of a showdown between church leaders and scholars, and it's not going well in those decades. And you see this conflict really emerging quite publicly.
That gets us to September 6th and all of that, right?
Yeah, that's sort of the culmination.
Yeah.
The 1993 excommunication of a number of scholars is really the culmination of these battles that had been happening for more than a decade between church leaders and scholars. And these are public fights. These are things that, again, most church members were aware of. These were followed in the national media, the conflicts between scholars and church leaders. And it really is a wrestle of two different kinds of authority, Is ecclesiastical authority, prophetic authority, the most important, or is knowledge and truth in an empirical way the most important set of values? And there's this conflict that isn't still resolved today, but really comes to the head in the 1980s and sets a lot of where we're at today. I think it can be traced back to some of those battles.
Say what you are noticing about this trajectory of Mormon intellectual thought and space. Sunstone, of course, founded by these idealistic believers. And then as the church evolves, there's a reaction. But then as technology evolves, there's also a reaction. Sunstone is having to, I'll put it this way, compete in a digital space that's packed with an array of different ideas and formats and styles. There's podcasts and YouTubers and social media influencers who are believers and not believers and former believers. And so what do you make of the sort of where we've ended up right now?
Yeah. In a way, this competition I think that Sunstone faces is probably ultimately healthy. No organization can just rely on its laurels. But the way that Latter-day Saints engage with their faith, critically or apologetically from an intellectual perspective, is often far outside of these old boundaries that where these conversations used to happen. You know, you'll get YouTubers who have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of followers who are not affiliated or connected or been a part of the Mormon scholarly community in any way whatsoever, right?
And may not know who they are.
No, and literally don't.
Yeah.
I had this moment of crisis a little bit when I was watching Secret Lives of Mormon Wives recently. Wow. And realized
– that's very brave of you to confess. Oh, yeah. Keep going.
That these Latter-day Saints are far more influential than any scholar, than all of the scholars put together, than all of the issues of Sunstone and dialogue in the last 60 years ever all added up, will never have the kind of social media and traditional media reach that some of these kind of other popular Latter-day Saint voices have.
It seems like the really deeply critical critique of Mormonism used to come from outside of the church. But I've heard others say that the call is now coming from inside the house, or from, as my producer mentioned, from the yard of the house, that now the criticism of the faith, the questions about its historicity and its, you know, patriarchal nature and its racist past is coming from ex-Mormons, Mormons on the fringe, even believers who still have those critiques. Do you think that's right?
I think it's right in part. There's always been an audience for ex-Mormon narratives. But at the same time, I think that a lot of the concern that you see over the course of the 20th century is that the Mormon intellectual is that threat from within, is an internal critic, somebody who can undermine the faith from within. And that's in part why so much suspicion is then cast on them, as opposed to the external critics that the church often ignored. So I think that in part, the boundary policing that the church does and its emphasis on a kind of like internal purity is in part an effort at self-preservation, because they see that internal threat as so potentially destabilizing. And it's why there has often been suspicion on Sunstone and some of these other organizations, because they have opened up that space for criticism inside of the tradition.
Let me ask you finally, what do you think all of this reveals about the changing face of Mormonism, the changing nature of Mormonism, or the challenges of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as it sort of moves into this new era?
It's always hard to tell what the present looks like. But I do think that the changing landscape of media produced by Latter-day Saints, by ex-Latter-day Saints, by intellectual and anti-intellectual Latter-day Saints is increasingly fragmented. And in part, it's because there's so much out there. Yeah. It's hard to keep on top of everything, and no one can. Everyone's always maybe consuming some little tiny corner of it. And I think that reflects a larger division in American society, and one that I think a number of social scientists have worried about, is that we're increasingly partisan and we're increasingly in our own bubbles. And we can find the way that the algorithms kind of train us into those bubbles is a way that we're actually becoming more alienated from one another. And so while I don't think that there's any risk of schism in the church anytime soon between the various factions, it does seem like we're talking to one another less and less and less. The fact that nobody knows about Sunstone or Dialogue or some of these other classical organizations anymore, I think is concerning, not just because what those organizations have done or are doing is particularly important, but because it shows a kind of lack of engagement with the past in a way that I think impoverishes our conversations in general.
Taylor Petrie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Taylor Petrie, he's a professor of religion at Kalamazoo College. The Sunstone Symposium begins tonight at the University of Utah Student Union Building. It runs through Saturday. We'll put a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the 50th anniversary of Sunstone. It's a journal or a magazine, but it's also a gathering where, I guess you could say, Mormon intellectuals work through the questions of faith and doubt and dissent and culture. And in the first part of the program, we were laying the groundwork for the intellectual tradition of Mormonism. Taylor Petrie was explaining how there were these bursts of energy and curiosity that set the stage for Sunstone and organizations like it. But now, we have to take on the question of whether Sunstone is relevant anymore, or certainly relevant in the way it used to be when it was the main hub for these kinds of conversations, when it was pushing boundaries and making church leaders really nervous. Because now the landscape for discourse about Mormonism is just crazy expansive. It's all over the place. It's a time when everyone who has an iPhone or a YouTube account can tell their story or express their hot take on the church. We asked Lindsay Hansen Park to join us. She's the executive director of Sunstone. And over the years, Sunstone has changed as the church and just culture has changed. To give us a sense of where it is now, though, we asked Lindsay, what was it like then in the early days?
I have a term for it that I very lovingly call sacred naivete. I think the founders were theological students who came from a Mormon background, who entered this larger landscape of religious discourse in academia, and they were like, wait, why can't we talk about our faith the same way that other faiths are doing this? It's so rich and it's so discursive and like there's so much depth to it, but in Mormonism it's very limited. And so they had this, I would call, intentional optimism of like knowing what the challenges were but deciding to embrace them anyway. And Sunstone really was formed out of this idea that Mormonism had more to say. And I just think that that's such a beautiful idea because I think that that's true, you know, in a religious community that's so, I would say, focused on or obsessed with the idea of truth. Truth is expansive and it's wide and it's big and we live in this huge universe of possibilities and potentials. And so why shouldn't your faith, a faith that claims to reflect that, why shouldn't you explore that and seek after that? And so the founders really tried to prove up on that idea. And I think it's Scott Kenny, one of the original founders, who quotes B.H. Roberts. And I'm going to butcher the quote, but it's something about Joseph Smith only, you know, revealed 1/100th of the truth. Huh. And so they were in search of that. What are the other parts? What can we explore? And I think that there's something really beautiful in the idea of like, it's not just Joseph Smith's job to reveal that truth, right? Mm. Like it's our responsibility. We get to go explore that wilderness. And that to me is the very heart of the best of our faith community.
So those people believed that's what Mormonism was, that it wasn't top down necessarily, even though it sort of technically is, but that Mormonism was about personal revelation and exploring all of these different ideas. Like that, they weren't diverging from Mormonism. They were leaning into what they thought Mormonism was.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it. And that's the tension that always exists in Mormonism, right? The tension of hierarchical power and authority to personal authority. And I don't think that that's ever going to be resolved. But somewhere in the messy middle of that is the idea of anyone that's grown up devoted to this religion and to this faith, you don't believe it belongs to one thing or one man or one person. It's yours. And you're living in it and you're breathing in it and you're choosing in it every day. And so the idea that like you don't have a right to explore those things, I think, is absurd to some people. Now, I do think that there is an oppressive culture, an oppressive side to that, where people really put an emphasis on the hierarchical power. And that's sort of a different mindset. But I know for myself, that's the Mormonism I was raised in. That's sort of what I believe, that it was this beautiful, expansive thing. And that's not to say that we didn't have problems or, you know, I didn't live out the religion in sort of some harmful ways too. But I really believed it was mine and I had a right to it and I had a right to explore. And it wasn't limited. I mean, my relationship with God wasn't there wasn't anything forbidden about what I could talk to God about, you know. And I think that that's kind of what they were embracing in their intentions in starting the organization.
You said that you can study the history of the LDS Church by studying the history of Sunstone. What do you mean by that?
You know, as I've been around this organization, it's 10 years now, I see that we're always sort of in tandem with them. You know, we're sort of a reaction of them. And when I look at the larger context of Mormonism, we're kind of a reflection of American history, right? The LDS Church is very American in its ideals and its structure and its implementation. And Sunstone is sort of a microcosm of the LDS Church in that way. And so I'll just give you an example that I'm thinking of. Depending on the cultural context of the time, that the, whatever the church is going through, Sansone is either reacting to that or reflecting that. And it happened to us a couple of years ago with the change, the Mormon change to Latter-day Saints, right? And it was in the larger context of identity politics. The world is sort of contending with, you know, being more precise in how you identify your pronouns or whatever it is. And so the churches, I guess how that shows up for the church is they decide to rebrand or refine their name. And when we're using Mormonism, we're talking about this large restoration tradition that encompasses groups outside of the LDS Church as well. But the LDS Church wants to be precise. They want to use the name of the church. And we had just, like, that year come up with our tagline, "There's more than one way to Mormon." And we actually had had billboards for it. So it was hard to not take it personally. Like, is it, Lord, is it I? Is it because of us? Like, did we use Mormon wrong? Did we use it too much on billboards? And I think it's interesting because we were also in this, in swimming in these waters of identity politics and realized, like, wow, there are so many different people in this tradition that express their Mormonism in different ways. And so we were going that direction while the church is going the opposite direction, you know? And so that's just kind of an example of that weird dance that we play, that we're sort of reacting to the same cultural, sociological, political climate. And whatever they do, then we have to respond to that. So when they come up with that prohibition of the use of Mormon, all of a sudden our branding is like satanic, right? And so we're like, okay, what does that mean? And we decided to lean into it further because it sort of, you know, the tension that they gave us sort of teed up better branding for us, I guess you'd say. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of how it feels. We're always dancing along with whatever they're doing.
Do you think that Sunstone remains as subversive as it seemed when it began, or certainly when the church started getting really worried about it in the 80s, does it still have that level of concern as far as you can tell from leader, or like, are leaders paying attention to Sunstone in the same way they used to be? I mean, there is a lot more out there, which we're going to talk about, but is it still seen as subversive?
Well, I think pluralism is always subversive. I mean, everyone wants to say that they embody it, but it, like I always say, it's easier to go to war than to live in peace with people you disagree with, you know? So I think the ideas that we embody are always going to be sort of fringy and subversive and sort of dangerous to folks. But as far as impact, I mean, when the symposium started in the 70s and 80s, it was like the only game in town, right? There was no internet. And so it was thousands of people coming and it had a lot of momentum. And then in 1991, the church puts out this statement against symposia. And it's very general, but, you know, they kind of say, don't go to these extra symposia. We were the only symposia around.
I wonder what they're talking about. Yeah.
Who could it be?
Right.
And so the apocryphal story is that it went from thousands of people to like 300 people overnight. And then it was like the sustained group of 300 people that were sort of outcasts and refugees in the intellectual world. But I think the institution is still scared of us because, you know, they have a prohibition against any of their BYU scholars, church employees presenting with us. So we that expresses itself with a lot of spy games, I guess. So we've got church employees or BYU employees that will present under pseudonyms, you know, so they can express their intellectual freedom and safety. And, you know, we've heard rumors about surveys and studies about the impact of what we're doing. But I don't think Sunstone is dangerous to the institution. I think it's necessary to the institution, to healthy communities. So I don't see us in conflict at all. And I think over the 10 years that I've been there, they can see that that's not our intention. We're not actively pulling people away from the faith, which I think was the fear. Now, that said, we do have scholars that have openly and actively challenged the institution. And that can be threatening. But, you know, truth should be proved up, right? So if you have the truth, then, like, stand firm in your values and don't be so scared of it. And I think that's where we land. We're we're not as scary as we used to be because, of course, there's the internet.
Yeah. And that's really scary.
The internet's scary. Yeah. It's breaking down all institutions, right?
For sure.
What an interesting time to be alive.
Well, here's the impression I have, or here's the impression I had, maybe I should put it that way, of Sunstone, that it was for people who felt – well, that it was for believers. It was for people who felt deeply committed to their faith, their LDS faith. But they found some of its leaders or practices problematic. They thought that leaders or Sunday school lessons didn't go deep enough, didn't really get to what they thought was the essence of it. So it was a way for these believers, not always Orthodox believers, but for them to meet and commiserate and talk about their conflicted feelings. And I guess the question is that still what Sunstone is today?
I think Sunstone is an archive of Mormon curiosity, however that looks, right? And so when you live in a faith that you feel is expansive in the theology, which I believe Mormonism is on paper in the scriptures, but then you live it out in your, you know, everyday sandy Utah ward, it can feel very sort of limited and sort of stuffy sometimes. And Sunstone and forums like this have become an outlet for that sort of curiosity. But, you know, we're 50 years of that. Archival, yeah. I always say the best scholars of Mormonism, probably most of the scholars of Mormonism, Mormon history, Mormon science, whatever you've got, have come through the doors of Sunstone, Orson Scott Card, like even Dallin H. Oaks. Mm. Like, they have been to these things because they are afflicted with curiosity. Mm. And so that's—
Wait, you're saying Sunstone is not a thing now. It's a collection. It has a history. You can't just think of it as this isolated thing right now because it has— a past. You describe it as an archive.
Yeah. I mean, we actually have a physical archive. We archive our stuff at the University of Utah as well. And it's 50 years of Mormon thought and really sort of a discursive Mormon thought. You get everything. You get like sociology, history, politics, culture, and everything in between. And I don't know of anywhere that does that. And for a group of people that are, you know, very engaged in record keeping, we are that. We are the history of what Mormons are thinking about outside of institutional boundaries. That's what you find at Sunstone.
That's Lindsay Hansen Park. She's the executive director of Sunstone. The organization's 50th anniversary symposium begins tonight. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Sunstone. This was one of the OG gathering spots for Mormon intellectuals, but it's 50 years old this year. And so we're asking where it stands in the online landscape where a whole universe of Mormon thinking and debate has blown wide open. We have with us the executive director of Sunstone, Lindsay Hansen Park. How do you react to those who say, well, Sunstone's not really for believers anymore? I was going through some Reddit comments, so I want to read one. And this is from Observant Member, so take that for what that is. And this person wrote, my impression is that Sunstone is pretty fringe. Decades ago, they didn't used to be, but nowadays it's run by people who hold positions adverse to the leadership of the church, and that it skews mostly disaffected, non-believing in the perspective, and most of the rest is on the more liberal, less orthodox side. How do you respond to that? Like, it's not – it used to be for believers, but believers don't go to Sunstone anymore. This is for ex-Mormons or super critical Mormons or – I mean, what do you say to that?
I would say they've been saying that since the 70s.
Is that right?
This is the central question. And I don't disagree with the comment, actually, but I just don't – I don't find offense at it. I don't see it as an accusation that I would want to shun. It reflects the Mormon culture's obsession with boundary maintenance, right? Who's in, who's out, who's good enough, who's faithful enough. And I call that faith politics. And I've been very ensconced in those since I got this job. Yeah. And I can tell you, it's just it's a funhouse of mirrors with a dead end at the end of that funhouse, because it's just trying to say who gets to have a voice and who gets to talk about the Mormon experience. And the reality is, it belongs to all of us. Anyone that's ever engaged this tradition has a stake in it. If you are affected by the history at all, it's yours. History is not a possession. Mm. It's a responsibility. And I think that too often we think we get really precious, we get really territorial about who gets to speak. And the idea that we are fringe, you know, has been used to sort of point a weapon like at Sunstone. And to me, it's a flower. It's like, yeah, we're fringe. And why aren't you? Because if we're honest with yourselves, everybody has thoughts that are a little bit strange or a little bit off the road or a little bit in disagreement with things. And we just ask you to explore and embrace those. We're not asking anyone to leave the church. We're not asking anyone to believe. Like, one of the things, we are really expansive. We have Mormon fundamentalists that come, by the way.
Yeah.
So this idea that it's
you
for believers.
You always have for a long time, right?
Yeah. And, you know, when the accusation of fringe was levied at us, you know, one of the things, the advice that I got early on in my role at Sunstone was, you just need to court more faithful people. And so I did. You know, I went to BYU. I had many lunches with professors, and they would all tell me the same thing. We love you. We support you. We can't be seen with you. And I realized, like, oh, it's kind of this weird game in this faith politics, right? That, you know, the LDS Church can say what they say. And then you've got BYU, who can be a little edgy, as long as they're in line with the institution, but at least they're not Dialogue. And then Dialogue can be a little edgy, but at least they're not Sunstone. Like, yeah. They need us to be the bad kids on the block, and that's not going away. And so I just thought, why don't we embrace it? You know, like, we are the fringe. The fringe is where the medicine happens. The fringe is where you touch Jesus's shawl, right? That's like where the medicine comes in. That's where the light shines in, is through these cracks. And so that's been a very successful approach for us. We've let in all the weirdos, right? The Mormon fundamentalists are welcome to come. Our one, you know, I guess, rule is that you can talk about your faith as much as you want, but you can't proselytize. And that's a really thin line for people, but we've done it successfully. I mean, it's not without challenges, but yeah. So this idea that, like, it is only for ex-Mormons or whatever, I guess that depends on how you look at thought that is outside of institutional narratives and what they find safe.
The question also hanging out there is, where do you fit now in this vast digital landscape where you've got YouTube channels and ex-Mormon blogs and social media? Social media, by the way, that is people who are on the fringe, wherever that boundary might be, or at least as they see it, and also those who are fully in and embracing their sort of conventional viewpoints. Like, there's so much out there. And I wonder, before we talk about how Sunstone fits into it, what do you see out there? And what does that tell you about the conversation about Mormonism when you look out there and see all of these things and hear all of these things?
Well, I'm a big fan of Carl Jung's idea of, like, everything casts a shadow, you know? And so I think that that means that there's a good and bad side to everything. And I know I'm a white lady. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to appropriate, like, the Hopi revelation of 2000. But I always think about it because there's such wisdom in it. And they say something like, there's a fast river. The future is a fast river. And your idea is to stay in the middle of the water and not get attached to the shore. And I think about that with this social media landscape. Like, if you're on TikTok, and no shade against TikTok, you know, like, it has its purpose. YouTube has its purpose. But when I'm on TikTok, I'm scrolling. It's you know, feeding into my ADD. I'm getting all kinds of ideas really quickly. And there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes I yearn for an anchor, right? I want to be pulled to sort of the middle of the pulse. And that's what Sunstone is. We're an analog repository. We're a symposium where people can come and engage face-to-face. It's not digital. I mean, it is digital. We have a digital component. But, sure, like, it sort of transcends that. And I think people are really hungry for that. I don't think that that's going to go away. That's part of human nature. We long to be together in community with each other. And social media can provide that. But I also think now that we're also, you know, two decades into social media, we're learning the limitations of that and sort of the shadow edge of that, which is it's watering down ideas. It's watering down truth. When you give everybody a voice, there's something really powerful in that. But then it's harder to discern, you know, what is truth and what is community and what are the limitations of that. And I think that that's a bigger question that, you know, is outside of who we are at Sunstone, and time will tell. But I do know that what we are seeing is people still come to Sunstone. I mean, we were back up to the old numbers at Sunstone. We have thousands of people that come. We have a large subscriber database. And so, yeah, I mean, in some ways, we worried about the relevancy. We thought, you know, when TikTok came, or I remember Vine was the big one. We're like, on Vine. We got to do that. And it just, what we're doing doesn't lend well to that. But, you know, as far as what I'm seeing, there are people that will come to Sunstone. They'll find a talk from, you know, from Richard Bushman in the 90s, and then they'll distill it onto TikTok. And as far as I'm concerned, that's exactly what we're here for, right? We're allowing those creators who are, there's a role and a purpose for them. They're getting information out in a different way now, and that's really exciting. But there's always going to need to be this archive, this historical memory, and that's the role that I see that we're fitting.
So in some ways, you're saying that if you change too much to adapt to this new digital environment, you're going to cease being the thing that you are and always wanted to be as an institution.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was an Ezra Klein interview. They were talking about this influencer economy. It's sort of like the coal miners in the railroad, right? Like the people that are the influencers are day in, day out using their body as labor to mine for these tech billionaires. And that was kind of this perspective change for me. I was like, oh, that's really what it is. Because if you've been an influencer, it is so much hard work. Like people think it's just getting on the camera and talking. It's not. You have to, you know, cut your video. It's a lot of work. And it's day in, day out to make it pay, right? And that's – it's just labor. It's this new kind of labor. And I think that what we're doing is different, and it has its place. And it, I do think we are going through a readjustment. And my worry is that maybe we'll lean in too far to the algorithm and whatever that, you know, the tech gods demand, and that will be the loss. But that's the struggle that we're facing right now. This loss of truth. I mean, we do need voices who are experts, who have peer review to say things. There is a utility to that that I think is not being appreciated, and the algorithm doesn't reward at all. But I think if we can stay the course and keep rooted in the middle of that river, that's where I think that people will always come looking.
It kind of gets me to, I guess, my last question, which is something that one of the co-founders of Sunstone, Peggy Fletcher Stack, said a while back. She talked about hearing from people who said that if it weren't for the magazine, if it weren't for Sunstone, they would feel lost and alone. And when I think about your own experience and what I think about what seems to be your aspirations for it, you just want the same thing. You want people to find it. People who are feeling lost, you want them to find something in Sunstone. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that it will find the people that need it. And also there's an invitation always in this, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, I always think of Church Apostle Dieter Uchtdorf, who says about the church, come, join with us. I always think about that with Sunstone. Come, join with us. We would love to see your faces here. Like, come, if you have a disagreement, bring it to us. You know, if you have a loneliness, bring it to us. I mean, this is the place to do that. It's the place where your curiosity, your quiet questions, things you can't speak out loud can be given voice and done in community. And there is no substitution for pain and loneliness and confusion and questioning and curiosity to be done outside of community. Like, people need community, and that's what we provide. And it's once a year, you know, that's what our symposium is. You rub shoulders with experts, but also with seekers. And that doesn't mean you have to stay in or out of the church. We sort of reject that idea. It's not about your institutional loyalty or affiliation. It's about your heart and your soul and what, on your journey of life, which we're all on, what medicine can you pick up along the way, you know? And to me, that's what knowledge is. It can be medicine. It can be a door. It certainly was for me, you know. When I came to Sunstone, I didn't know anything. I had no institutional knowledge. I just had a lot of, like, drive and enthusiasm. And it's that sacred naivete that we talked about. That optimism should be a resource for everybody, right? That is at the heart of what life is about, is being able to challenge your curiosity, explore it, and especially the things that they tell you not to talk about, right? Those are the things we should be bringing into the light the most. And that's what we do.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Lindsay Hansen Park. She's the executive director of Sunstone. Their annual symposium begins this evening at the University of Utah Student Union Building. It runs through Saturday. We'll put a link to that, by the way, on the website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.